Greetings. Bernard McGinn is one of the greatest living authorities on Catholic historical theology. He earned his a doctorate in theology from the Pontifical Gregorian University in Rome in 1963 and a PhD in history from Brandeis University in 1970. After teaching for a year at the Catholic University of America, he joined the Chicago faculty in 1969, where he taught until his retirement in 2003. He remains the Naomi Shenstone Donnelly Professor Emeritus at the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. While now retired, he continues to teach, lecture, and publish, including on his long-range project of On History of Christian Mysticism. He also was instrumental, as Thomas mentioned, in helping found the Lumen Christi Institute. Among many other texts, he has also published with his wife, collaborator, and today slide projector operator, Pat, a primer for Christian mystical texts called Early Christian Mystics. He also recently published a book on Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, which is available outside. And I was fortunate enough to take a class with him on the Summa 3 years ago. And it was really only on that third encounter with the Summa where, beyond understanding Thomas, I came to appreciate and revere him under Bernard McGinn's tutelage. Bernard McGinn has left a lasting impact on the study of the history of Christian thought, not only with his extensive publications, but with the scholars he has formed, having directed 66 dissertations in his time. Please join me in welcoming Bernard McGinn.
Well, welcome to you all, and my deepest thanks to Michael and to Thomas for the invitation, and my sincere gratitude to all of you who've come here today to honor Ireland and Irish Christianity, which has been a hobby of mine, for many, many decades now. And what I'm going to try to do this afternoon is take you on a kind of guided tour. It's a slide lecture, actually, because since 1960, which is the first time I visited Ireland, I've been taking pictures of Irish, particularly monastic sites and histories. And I've tried to visit as many of the great early Irish monasteries and locations as I possibly could, as well as, of course, reading in that field of studies. So what this is, then, this lecture is a kind of summation of, along with visual presentation, of the importance of early Irish monasticism. Well, it all starts with St. Patrick. Patrick, sometime in the middle of the 5th century, wrote a confession, a confessio, which is one of the great documents, really, of the late antique church. And he starts, let me just read the first line or so in Latin here. Ego patricius peccator rusticissimus et minimus omnium fidelium et contemptibilissimus apud plurimos. So I am Patrick, a real rustic sinner, rusticissimus peccator, and the least of all the faithful and the most contemptible among many. And he starts, his other surviving work is a letter that he wrote to a British chieftain who had been kidnapping Irish, taking Irish people to serve as slaves. And he starts the same way. He says, I'm Patrick. He said, here he admits, peccator, I'm a sinner. But I'm also the bishop of the Irish, Episcopus Hiberniae. Now, we know a good deal about Patrick, but much has been added on in terms of legendary accretion over the centuries. He was born in Britain, as he tells us in his confessio. He's kidnapped as a young man, a teenager, brought to Ireland, serves as a slave for many years, escapes, wanders on the continent. This is a period of the barbarian invasions, and probably was trained monastically. He doesn't say much about that, but we have some information. And eventually, he comes back to Ireland, traditionally around the year 432. And he serves probably for 20 years or so. Patrick was not the first Christian leader sent to Ireland. We know that there were Christians in many places in Ireland, particularly in the south. Patrick's missionary activity was mostly in the north, and that's where he has many associations. And he gives us a picture, a wonderful picture, of that kind of Christian motif here in the early part of the 5th century. Two things are important about this, though. First of all, in his confession, Patrick tells us, and I'll read this, this text, Christ said, "Proclaim this gospel of the kingdom throughout the whole world as a testimony to all pagans, and then the end will come. The end will come. Tunc veniet finis." Patrick lived in a kind of shadow of the last coming, the second coming. He felt that the whole world needed to be converted before Christ would return, but that was going to be pretty quick. That's typical of a lot of 5th century Christians. And the other text that I want to read you also comes from the Confessio, where he says that the sons and daughters of the small Irish kings are seen to be made monks and virgins of Christ. Monks and virgins of Christ. So while Patrick was the bishop appointed to convert the Irish, he began the process of forming monks and virgins, monachi et virgines, in the Irish church. It's very significant then that the Irish church was a monastic church in a certain sense right from the beginning, and that's where we'll be turning to the slides in just a few minutes. Of course, the nature of this Irish church begun by Patrick is unusual. One of the great scholars of early Irish Christianity, a woman named Kathleen Hughes, said, "Ireland was odd in the early Middle Ages. Ireland was odd, and it was odd. It was quite different in many ways. First of all, because of the concentration on a monastic style of church, but also in terms of many other aspects of Irish Christianity, because Ireland had never been a part of the Roman Empire. So it was a different kind of culture, a tribal Celtic culture. And the Christianity of early Ireland then, down to the 12th century or so, was really rather different. Not that the Irish were, you know, were opposed to Rome and the Western church model, but they had their own way of doing things, as they still do today, probably. And of course, this leads to various different interpretations of the nature of early Irish Christianity. A German scholar some years ago put this very well. The problem of studying early Ireland is the struggle between what he called Iromania and Irophobia. Iromania or Irophobia. You've heard all these things about how the Irish saved Western civilization. That's Iromania. And believe me, it's not really true. The early Irish church was important, but let's not become maniacal over its significance. But the other side of this would be Irophobia, the idea that somehow because Irish Christianity was rather different and outside the mainstream, that there was something wrong with it and something that needed to be corrected. So, I think I'm going to turn to the slides here, and if we could have the first, okay. I know some of these will be a little dark, and I know some of you at the far end there may have trouble seeing that, but we'll start with Patrick. And what you're looking at here well, it's typical of Ireland, it's a green field. But it's actually a green field of Tara, the seat of the Irish High Kings. And of course, according to later legends, Patrick himself doesn't mention this, but later legends, the legendary lives of Patrick that begin in the middle of the 7th century, it was here in Tara, which was the center of the Irish kingship system, with its banquet halls and various other things, that St. Patrick encountered King Leary on an Easter Eve, sometime early in the in his missionary activity. And there are many legendary accretions about that. And the king was supposed to be lighting the first flame, you know, at that particular time. And instead, Patrick lit the Easter candle flame and all this stuff that went on. But that's what you see when you go to Tara today. And you still see things relating to Patrick, if I could have the next. If you go to the National Museum in Dublin, many of you have probably been there, they have this cowbell, more or less. Well, this is supposed to be St. Patrick's bell. And we do know that, you know, ringing a bell, carrying a bell, was one of the things that the missionaries at this time did. Whether this bell goes back as far as Patrick or not is almost impossible to know. It was considered Patrick's bell. So in the 12th century, the shrine of St. Patrick's bell was made for this, one of the wonderful examples of early Irish metalwork. But what we know about the historical Patrick really comes from those two documents, the Confessio and that famous letter. And then you have the great accretion of legendary materials. So what then about the early history of the church that Patrick and others had formed here in the middle of the 5th century? Well, traditionally, according to the Collection of the Irish Saints, it's a document produced around the year 800 or so, there were two great early ages of Irish Christianity. The first is called the Age of the Bishops, because Patrick established episcopal sees and consecrated people as bishops, so that this catalog of Irish saints reads, "The first order of Catholic saints was in the time of St. Patrick, and then they were all bishops, distinguished and holy and filled with the Holy Spirit, 350 of them, and the founders of churches." We know very little about that period of time. This is from, let's say, St. Patrick's coming, maybe 430 or so, till about 530. That first century is an age of bishops. We have names of people, but we have very little else. Where we do begin to have an extensive historical record is the so-called Second Order of Irish Saints. The Second Order of Irish Saints, and this is the order of the great monastic founders. Because by this period, the 6th century, it's quite clear that the Irish church is primarily a monastic church. Why was this a case? It's a case because the Roman system that had been set up and the beginnings of Christianity was set up in Rome with cities as centers. Bishops were located in the great urban centers around the Mediterranean world. There were no cities in Ireland. There were no cities. Ireland was a tribal society organized in a different way without urban centers. And the episcopal model, in a certain sense, that was used and found all over Western Europe didn't work in Irish society. What did work was the network of tribes and the various kings of the tribes. And so what we find is that the monastic system in Ireland becomes a kind of tribal system. Great monastic founders organize monasteries based upon their own tribes and the network of people connected with their own tribes. And even the word for monastery in Ireland in the Latin text of this time is city, civitas. So what centers existed were the great monasteries that were founded with numerous connections to other monastic centers, usually organized around particular tribes and using the legal systems and the mode of life of Irish society. So that the nature of Irish society as tribal, agrarian, without urban centers, and the influence, of course, of the monastic ideals in general in that period in Western Christianity, makes the Irish church an unusual kind of form of monastic church. So when we talk about early Irish Christianity, we're primarily talking about a monastic Christianity. Even the bishops were frequently abbots of monasteries, or else lived within the monasteries under the control of the abbot, and the bishop would have a much more liturgical function than what we would call an ecclesiastical function. So this was the period of great monastic founders, the period 550 to about 700 or so. Many of these names come down to us, both of men and of women. Bridget of Kildare, who's said to have been born around 450 and perhaps died 520, founded a monastery for both men and women at Kildare. And we have an early life of Bridget from the 7th century, around the same time they were writing lives of St. Patrick. There's a lot of legendary material about her. Some modern historians have wondered, did she really exist or not? We don't know, but we know some of the other figures certainly were historical. These 12 founders, the 12 great early monastic founders, Enda of Arran, Finian of Clonard, who is said to have 12 disciples, the 12 apostles of Ireland. And then we get to historical figures whose monasteries still exist. And yes, let's, okay. Kevin of Glendalough. Many of you may have been to Glendalough. It's not all that far from Dublin. Sometime in the early 6th century, supposedly around the year 530 or so, founds a monastery in this Glen of the Two Lakes, as it's called. He's described in one of the Irish martyrologies as follows. A soldier of Christ into the land of Ireland, a high name over the sea's wave, Kevin the Chase, the fair warrior, in the Glen of the True Broad Lakes. The Irish poet Samuel Lover in the 19th century puts it this way. It's not great poetry, but at Glendalough lived a young saint in odor of sanctity dwelling, an old-fashioned odor which now we seldom or never are smelling. According to the legends, Kevin began, as many did, as a hermit. And if we could have the next slide. This is the Upper Lake, as it's called. There's two big lakes with a river flowing between them and then down into valley. This is the Upper Lake. And somewhere around there on that hillside, Kevin is supposed to have lived for many years as a hermit. And according to legends, with his hands outstretched for so long, the birds built their nests and all this kind of stuff. Well, these are the great legends. But we do know that he did, after abandoning his lake, come down, and if we could, into the valley, and founded a monastic civitas, which you're looking at. Now, of course, he does this in the 6th century, but this is a long, long-range monastery. Most of the buildings that survive at Glendalough date from about the 8th or 9th century through the 12th century. This is what, like many monasteries, it has a round tower. It also has this unusual small structure, which is called, today they call it Kevin's Kitchen. No one knows why, but it used to be called Kevin's House for many, many centuries. And it's probably 11th and 12th century. Irish churches were small. Originally, they were wooden churches. Stone churches begin to be built from the 7th, 8th century on. There's another view of Kevin's Kitchen. And this will give you an idea. The Irish monasteries would be surrounded by a wall to mark off the sacred enclosure. Very few of those walls survive today, but this is one portion. This is the main entrance. This is the main entrance gate, again, probably late 12th century or so. And like other of the Irish monasteries, there are several churches scattered around within the monastic enclosure. This is the ruins of the so-called cathedral church, which is probably pretty late 12th century or so. Somewhat earlier is the next church, which is called the Trinity Church today, might be from around the 10th century or so. So small, some people have thought it might actually be something like more like a baptistry or the like. But that'd give you a general sense of the Irish monastery, the Irish civitas. An enclosure wall and a scattering of churches, round towers, and as we'll see, monumental crosses, which is one of the other features of early Irish Christianity. Along with, or contemporary with Kevin, was St. Kieran of Clonmacnoise, who studied with the very early Irish founders. And what you're looking at there is an overall view of Clonmacnoise. It's right up over the River Shannon in the center of Ireland, supposedly founded about 548. Very important location since its central position. Burial place for the Irish kings. It was the place where a number of important Irish works, Irish documents, annals, and various summations of early Irish legends were also produced in the course of the 8th, 9th century. And let's move on. Just get that a little more in focus, yeah. Here's the round tower, and you can see, again, a very small church. This is called Kieran's Cell, and probably is a pretty early church, not 6th century, but maybe 8th or 9th century. And Clonmacnoise features some of the wonderful Irish crosses, which are kind of the distinctive mark of early Irish Christianity. The exact origins of these monumental crosses, there are about 100 of these in Ireland, by the way, that survive. I've seen, I think, about 50 or 60 of them. Some of them are in very good condition. Some of them are just mere fragments. Actually, this picture I took many years ago when this cross of the scriptures, this is called, dates from the year 914, we have an inscription. This cross of the scriptures was outside the church. Now, a lot of these crosses have been moved inside into museums in order to preserve them because of the effects of weathering and everything else. So this is the cross of the scriptures, and this is the west face. Let's go back, Pat, to the, oh, there you, can we go back? Okay, on the west face of most of the Irish crosses, you have a crucifixion scene. Christ's arms outstretched, and then of course you have these little panels that come down, three or four, or sometimes five, with various scenes from both the Old and the New Testament. Many times these are identifiable, and in some cases there's still a lot of arguments among the scholars as well, what does this scene actually mean? So that's the west face. On the east face, you have Christ's second coming in glory. Christ carrying these emblems on his chest, which look almost like symbols from Egyptian antiquity, some people have thought. And you can see on either side emblems or figures representing the Last Judgment. So crucifixion on one side, second coming on the other side. You might say the two bookends of Christian history. Christ's first coming in death for the salvation of humanity, and then his second coming. These crosses seem to have had a liturgical function with regard to certain processions and certain kind of prayer rituals, etc. And many of the monasteries had multiple crosses, as indeed Clonmacnoise did as well. Here's at the base of one of these. Well, here's a little detail. This is David playing his, it's not his bagpipes, but I guess it's his flute. We can go ahead. And we have actually an inscription. This is a prayer for Abbot Coleman, who was responsible for the erection of the cross. So there are a whole range of these figures. Some monasteries survive quite well, others not quite as well. Perhaps the most famous of the 6th century founders is St. Columba, Columbkill, of Derry and Iona, whose dates we know are pretty accurately 521 through 597, who was one of the most important royal families in the north of Ireland, and who founded a number of monasteries, Derry and Dara. But at one stage, the famous first copyright case in history was the downfall of St. Columba. He borrowed a manuscript from a neighboring founder, a neighboring Saint Finian, and had the monastery had the manuscript copied. And then he sent it back to Saint Finian, and Saint Finian demanded that the copy be sent back. Columba refused, and the two monasteries went to war. which was quite typical, because if these monasteries are connected with the Irish tribal society and the Irish tribes are always fighting with each other, we have many cases of Irish monasteries or groups of monasteries, parroquiae, going to war with each other. So, Battle of Kuldrevni, it's called, about 563 or 564. They went to battle and numerous people were killed, and finally all the monastery, all the abbots got together and said, Columba, you got to get out of here. We don't want you around anymore. So he went to Scotland to found the monastery of Iona in 563, and became the missionary, really, of first missionary of the Scottish Church. He was noted as a copier of manuscripts. The oldest surviving Irish manuscript, you can find it in the Royal Library in Ireland, is said to be by Columba's hand. That's a question whether it is or not, but it could be, because it dates from the end of the 6th century. He was a very noted poet, and a number of poems that seem to be his survive. And also what does survive are some of his monasteries and their ruins. So I want to look at a little bit about the monastery of Duro in the north, founded in 556. It has one of these high crosses, smaller than the others that we've seen. And again, it wouldn't be from his period. This high cross is probably from around the 10th century or so. And you have both sides. You have crucifixion side and then a Last Judgment side. But from that Columban monastery of Duro, we have probably the earliest surviving of the great decorated Irish manuscripts. Yeah, sorry, some of these slides I bought so many years ago that they're fading. But this is the Book of Duro, which is the first and earliest of the great decorated manuscripts, probably from around the year 700. These were generally New Testament or gospel books or liturgical books. So you have the four gospels and frequently decorated pages with the symbols of the various evangelists, and also with what they call carpet pages, which are large pages of pure decoration. You can see a carpet page there on the left-hand side. We can get a little... Yeah, this is the eagle page, symbol of the Gospel of John. Here's another one. You can see, of course, the great delicate calligraphy as well as the decoration, that you have the marginal decorations with decorated initials, etc. It's the beginning of Mark. And here, the next one is magnificent carpet page that is at the beginning of the Gospel of John. So you'd have the figure of earlier on in the manuscript, you have the figure of John the evangelist as the eagle. Then at the beginning of the text of the Gospel itself, right before the beginning in Principio, Erat Verbum, you'd have this decorative carpet page, as it's called. So, I mean, there are many other particular examples of early monasteries founded in the course of the 6th century that then go on and on and on for many, many centuries. Some of them are by very well-known saints, some of them by saints that are not so well-known. If we can go to the next slide. This is the monastery of Monasterboice, which is just north of Dublin, 20 or 30 miles. We know almost nothing about the saint, Saint Buithi, who founded that. Who he's said to have died in 521. It would make it a very early monastery. But it is, again, one of the best examples of surviving early Irish monastic enclosure, an Irish monastic civitas. This is a general view. Here's the round tower. And it also has no less than three crosses. This is Murdoch's cross, Abbot Murdoch. And again, we can date it pretty precisely, 922. The west face here with the crucifixion. This is perhaps one of the most magnificent of all the Irish crosses. Here's your crucifixion. On the other side, you have a Last Judgment scene and numerous Old and New Testament scenes as well. Here's a little detail. What exactly these two guys are doing. It's a beard-pulling contest. And you also have in at Monastir Boise, next slide. Yeah, this is the so-called tall cross, which is about 22 feet high and is the tallest of the surviving Irish high crosses, as they're called. So your high crosses can range from, you know, 4 or 5 feet high to well over 20 feet high. Perhaps the best example of a surviving, almost untouched, although ruined, Irish monastery is also not as well known, and even the founder, St. Molaise, whoever he was, lived in the second half of the 6th century and founded his monastery on an island in Sligo Bay at Inishmurray, the island of Murray. It's now an abandoned island. People lived on it until about 1950 or so, dwindling population, and then eventually they all moved off the island so that there's nothing there now. Pat and I went there 1980s, I think the early 1980s, and there was no access to the island except by way we went on a boat with the county workers from County Mayo who were going out there to do work on the island, and we were able to go on the boat. I understand now they have tours to the monastery, and if you ever get the chance, this is your best view of what an early Irish monastery would have looked like. That's looking back. And here, you can see the enclosure wall, and then you have a series of churches scattered throughout. No high crosses at Inishmurray. So this is the so-called Cashel. And then, next slide, the very little church there with the moss growing on the top of it is the old church, probably an 8th century church, dedicated to St. Molaise, the founder, whoever he was. But you have these beehive huts as well, scattered throughout the monastic enclosure. Those are the ruins in the distance there. Those are the ruins of the village that used to exist. And here's one of the beehive huts. And you also have a series of altars scattered around. Well, again, will be part of a kind of processional sacrality. And you also have on these altars the cursing stones. The cursing stones, Irish saints, and most Celtic saints, the Welsh perhaps even more so, were great for cursing. They're enemies, obviously. They're enemies. Don't annoy an Irish saint. And these stones that, you see, she's not ready to curse, but she's going to give an example. You turn the stone around several times, muttering curses, and it's supposed to be quite effective. So, I don't know. So that's called the Clocha Brecha altar and the Clocha Brecha cursing stones. Now, Irish monasticism was not just a local phenomenon, but almost from the start of the 6th century, the Irish began to spread abroad and had a very powerful effect throughout Western Europe in this time of, you know, barbarian decline and decay. And I mentioned Columba going to Scotland, going to Iona, and founding a very important monastery there. It was probably one of the centers. I mean, Christianity in England and Scotland comes from two sources. It comes from the south through Canterbury, where the Roman missionaries arrived, who had been sent by Pope Gregory the Great. And 2 decades later, it comes from the north through the activity of the Irish monks, particularly Iona, that great center. And of course, nothing remains of the early things. This is the cathedral at Iona, which is really 12th to the 15th century, has been rebuilt in the 20th century. If we could move. That's the interior of the cathedral. And, yeah. Let's move on. It has high crosses. It has 3 high crosses, not with figures, but with merely decoration. And it does have this kind of little hill, which you're looking at, which is called the Tor Abh. And at least according to legend, this is where Columba himself used to retire to pray and also to copy manuscripts.
Here's a view from the top of Torab, which might have been a foundation, a hut foundation from the earlier period. The oldest of the surviving churches on Iona at this time is this thing called the Relig Oren that you're looking at. It's probably 11th or 12th century. And you have the St. Martin's cross. That's another maybe 10th or 11th century. You also have some cross slabs. This next slide is not very interesting, but these are earlier. These are like 8th or 9th century. So if you get a chance to visit Iona, it's one of the sacred places, a thin place, as the Celts often call it, the thin barrier that separates the heavenly world from the world of ordinary experience. Also important, along with Columba, was Columbanus. Columbanus was another northern monk trained at the great monastic center in Bangor, of which nothing survives. We visited there several years ago, and the situation is there, but nothing of the monastery. Was one of the great intellectual centers of early Irish Catholicism. But Columbanus began wandering for the sake of Christ, exile for the sake of Christ, as it was called. And he went first to Gaul, present-day France, Merovingian Gaul, founded several monasteries there, eventually got in trouble with the kings for denouncing the king's illegitimate sexual escapades and had to flee the country. And he went to present-day Switzerland, where he spent several years founding several monasteries. And then he moved on and wound up in Italy, founding a monastery in northern Italy at a place called Bobbio. This would have been the year 613. And all of the monasteries, Luxeuil, at St. Gallen, at Bobbio, and numerous others that Columbanus founded became kind of centers for the spread of Irish Christianity throughout Europe, Western Europe, from the period here of the late 6th, 7th century on through the 12th century. And the Irish certainly were very important in terms of the copying of manuscripts, missionizing the areas, etc. I mean, that's chapter of Iromania, I think, is true. Just a slide or two to represent Columbanus. This is what we were just looking at was Lake Constance, which is where Columbanus was actively missionizing in the period about the year 600 and shortly afterwards. Then from the Bobbio, and I thought I had from the Bobbio Monastery, there's a great collection of early Irish manuscripts that now survive in Italian libraries after the Bobbio Monastery was closed down in the 17th century. This is one of those. It's the Last Judgment scene, by the way. This, by the way, is a church. It's a Baroque church from the 18th century at St. Gallen. It was one of the disciples of Columbanus, not an Irishman himself, a local Alemannic Christian who founded the monastery of St. Gall. But that monastery was also a center for Celtic Christianity. Many Irish monks lived there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's one of the major centers for the production of early Irish manuscripts that survived today. Let's just look at, this is the so-called St. Gall Gospel Book, probably from around the year 750 or so. And this is the Last Judgment scene from the St. Gall Gospel Book. It's one of the best examples. We've seen the Last Judgment scenes on the high crosses. We also have these Last Judgment scenes in the Irish manuscripts. The other major location for missionizing in England was the monastery of Lindisfarne. Iona's on the west coast of Scotland. Lindisfarne was on the east coast of England, Northumbria, really. And here it was of St. Aidan, who was a monk at Iona, who was called by the kings of Northumbria to come down and found a monastery. And like Iona, this was an island monastery. What you're looking at here, you can see that dim little bump on the horizon. That's the Isle of Lindisfarne. and you're looking at it from Bamburgh Castle, which was the seat of the kings of Northumbria, who had summoned Aidan down to found this monastery in the 630s or so. Looking back, you can see the king's castle up there, and then you're looking at the end of Lindisfarne itself, and up to the right hand, you'll see another little dim kind of island. That's Farne Island, which was the site of the hermitage for St. Cuthbert, again, one of the great missionizers of this period, who himself, of course, was a Saxon, but who had been trained by the Irish monks. Lindisfarne was another major center, but almost nothing survives from the Celtic period. As you know, Lindisfarne is an island for part of the day, but when the tide, well, it's an island when the tide comes in. When the tide goes out, you can go back and forth, but you better not let the tide catch you as you're on the causeway. People have actually, it comes in very quickly because of the flatness of the area, and people have drowned. They have little huts on stilts built throughout, so if you get caught in the tide, you can go run and climb up. The church that survives there is not Celtic church, it's a 12th century Augustinian priory. But you still get the flavor of the Irish desire, you know, for being on a kind of sea scape, in a sense, with wonderful sunsets. Yeah, if we could. Lindisfarne Gospels. One of the other great treasures of early Irish manuscript illumination. And here are two slides, again, pretty early, around 750 or so. This is the opening of the Gospel of John. So just in the time that remains here, I just want to give a few further notes about the later history. I mean, this has been largely restricted to the early period. Irish monasticism went through various reform movements. Again, the fact that it was so entrenched in the local tribal society led to lots of problems and issues. Married monks, warfare between various monastic houses, etc. Around the year 750 or 800, a great monastic reform began in Ireland called the Culdee Reform, from the Gaelic for servant of God. And a number of new monastic houses were formed by a new generation of Irish leaders, these Culdee readers. And one of the most interesting of those is the monastery of Castle Dermot. This is in Wicklow, about 50 or 60 miles south of Dublin. Dermot was an abbot of Iona, but who decided to join the Reform movement and founded this monastery at Castle Dermot. The church here obviously is a modern church, but the round tower is old, and there are a number of high crosses, two high crosses and several other stones. They're a little hard to make out there. They're smaller, and their decoration is probably not quite with the finesse of some of the other examples. But you get the general picture. The second major change that I want to emphasize is the Viking invasions. Beginning in 793, the Viking hordes descended upon Lindisfarne. I mean, that's where the money was, let's remember. This was the centers of production in the society. They also had metal work that would be quite precious. They also had workers who could be taken as slaves, etc. So since there were no cities in Ireland, the Vikings devastated the monasteries. And frequently, over and over again, in 795, Iona was sacked by the Vikings for the first time, and then several other times as well. So in the early 800s, a number of the monks from Iona actually went back to Ireland, figuring it was safer, And one of the monasteries they founded was the Monastery of Kells. And you're looking here at one of the ancient Celtic churches in Kells itself. And of course, what Kells is perhaps most famous for is the Book of Kells, the greatest treasure of early Irish manuscript illuminations, found, of course, nowadays at Trinity College in Dublin. It was probably written and illustrated at Iona, but then taken back for safekeeping to Kells itself. And just a few examples of some of the decorated pages there. Again, these slides don't do the book justice because they're old and they've gotten kind of washed out over the years. This is a Virgin and Child. The next scene is a temptation of Christ, Christ being taken up to the top of the temple. And then you have some examples of the illumination, the decorated miniatures for different initials. I'm going to close with some pictures from perhaps the most, shall we say, romantic or exotic of all the early Irish monasteries, particularly the island monasteries. This is Skellig Michael. I don't know whether any of you had the opportunity to visit there, but it's really a totally remarkable site. It's 12 miles. It's a pinnacle of rock, 12 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean off the Kerry coast, with a monastery. We don't quite know how old the monastery is. There's very little that survives. A few mentions in some of the Irish chronicles about some of the abbots there. But it flourished for a long period of time. It was sacked by the Vikings. The Irish annals note several abbots who were killed by Viking incursion, etc. And you can still go out, if the weather is good enough, and land on Skellig Michael and ascend with some laborious difficulties up to the top and come to the site of the monastery itself. With the beehive huts that remain, and here's a view. This is Little Skellig. We're on Big Skellig. Little Skellig, because nobody lives on that or ever did. It's a bird sanctuary. But this will give you an idea of the location with the Kerry coast off there. And the fact, here are these monks living out here, one of the most desolate places in the world. What did they eat? Well, they ate a lot of fish, I imagine. But and they survived for many, many centuries. And quite recently, oh, here's one. Here's a very crude cross there, an incised kind of cross. There's no place for very fancy high crosses. And the monastery is not on the highest peak. It's at about 550 feet high. But from the monastery, you look across to the 720-foot spire. And only within living memory, about a generation or so ago, they discovered there was a little hermitage built on the other side of that steep rock where one or two monks would live in almost total isolation from human connection. So this will give you some idea, I think, of the nature of early Irish monasticism. And let me just finish here by quoting a brief prayer, 8th or 9th century prayer from the Irish monks. It's a prayer about undertaking a journey, an actual trip, or maybe the journey of life. This is how the prayer goes. The path I walk on, Christ walks it. May the land in which I am be without sorrow. May the Trinity protect me wherever I stay, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. May every path before me be smooth. May man, woman, and child welcome me. This is truly a good journey. Well does the fair Lord show us a course and a path to life. So, thank you.